Are you chuckling weird. About the leaf blower?
Yeah, I don't know.
I wonder if the students can even hear it, though. It's faint to me, but of course my hearing is terrible.
They probably can't hear it. I'm not really started yet, but it's starting. Okay, you ready?
Yeah. What's starting?
Hi, Joe.
Hello.
You know what's strange?
What?
This is a new recording.
Yes.
Who knows when people are going to be listening to this?
That's fair.
100 years from now, when...
Yes, you know, archaeologically, they're all old.
But this is 2022 now.
And some of the recordings students will have heard of us are from years past.
Years past.
Years before 2022.
Quite old. We were different people then.
We will be different people tomorrow, too.
Well, you make a good point. But not necessarily so relevant for the students. You know, what we are tomorrow, like, they'll be done with this class. Oh, yeah, remember that old guy who taught me this thing? Like, it won't matter so much, right?
Yeah, fair point.
So we're going to talk today. So, if you can put yourself back in the mind of years ago when you recorded those things. But, of course, you've seen the material. So,
yeah.
The students have now gotten an idea of legal systems, legal argument, rules and standards, duty breach, causation, damages, defenses, kind of the, you know, how a legal claim is broken down, and then how you would argue that the elements of that claim are met or not met. And so now we're just going to try to get some practice with that. And so I've selected a couple of cases, one of which the students will discuss this week and one they'll discuss next week.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we could just talk about those.
Sounds fun.
If you're up for it.
Totally. Did you know, perhaps you did know, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I have a feeling you didn't know.
Oh.
That the Lord Chief Justice...
It's always a good feeling to have that I didn't know. It's always a pretty good bet.
Yeah. It's not uncommon.
All right.
The Lord Chief Justice, who delivers the opinion in Dudley and Stevens...
Just a case in England, if the Queen's Bench wasn't a giveaway for the students.
Right.
Like the second in this Foundations of American Law class, the second case we're reading is from not America.
Right. Although the Anglo-American tradition
is a foundation.
It's a wonderful thing. It's an important thing.
Yeah.
And we still are looking to cases in the United Kingdom and less often, but not unheard of that we might look at a case from Canada or Australia or New Zealand or Hong Kong or other places that are part of the originally, of course, this is all about empire, which has an interesting connection to Dudley and Stevens. But the point I was going to make was that the Lord Chief Justice, Coleridge,
mm-hmm.
Was a great nephew of the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Okay.
So for the poetry fans in the room, if you're real fans of Coleridge's poetry, this is his great nephew.
Is that the end of the story?
That's the thing I wanted to impart.
So that was more of a nugget than like a story with an implication.
True, although I will say not every judge is likely to quote Milton's Paradise Lost, one of the more famous poems from that period in England's history.
Is it surprising that a fancy judge in England would be related to someone else who is a member of the elite? this is not a surprise, right?
That's probably right. I mean, the number of, really fancy people, it's not huge.
Yeah. I mean, it's a club that likes to keep its own numbers low.
Perhaps, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that's my take. So, that kind of trivia always reminds me of that fact.
Yes. And we're back in this case, back in 1884?
1884.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the event referenced late in the opinion, the sinking of the Birkenhead was only about 25 or 30 years in the past at that point. So it's a more culturally current thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a ship that sank, and there were not very many lifeboats, and there were some women and some kids and lots of soldiers, and the soldiers famously stood in lines on the deck of the ship, and so that the women and children could get in the lifeboats,
right.
And the ship sank.
Right.
So the soldiers went down with the ship,
right,
demonstrating that they understood in that moment that it was their duty to do that.
Demonstrating some kind of action that, that the people were proud of.
Yes.
I mean, so there's kind of a, you know,
and that their own lives might not be the most important thing
right.
for them to attend to at that moment.
It's kind of a contribution to a moral mythology.
Well, and I think...
Based on a real event.
Right, a
sure,
contribution to a moral mythology by doing an actual thing.
Right, right, yeah. right. But, you know, the real event assumes a kind of mythological force within the moral system. But, it, you know, we'll come back to that. So,
okay.
You know, it's one of the touchstones. Like, how should one act? Well, like in this story, you know, we in America, we tell the story of, you know, George Washington not telling a lie. It's probably
yeah.
mythological, right?
Yeah.
And serves maybe a similar function, but you know, maybe there's some truth in some of our stories too, but it's not the truth that matters as much as it is as the story of character.
Mm.
But we'll come back. I want to hear where you think these, the reasons for the outcome in this case, where do they come from? But let's, before we get there.
Oh, I thought we were talking about that.
We were, but I think we should kind of, first, you know, before this case, I actually assigned Orrin Kerr's piece on how to read a legal opinion.
Yeah.
Which is, in many ways, kind of reinforcing a lot of what I'd written in the earlier part of it, but more kind of more concrete about like an actual opinion. Like,
yeah.
here are the pieces of the opinion. Here's why
yep.
we use the word justice and judge. And
yep.
here's what it means to reverse and vacate a case. So
it's a great essay.
It really is. And it's very practical and hopefully helpful. And of course, it refers to a lot of things in American law, which are also true of this case. Like you look at the caption here and it says the Queen versus Dudley and Stevens. And I was pleased that he dropped a footnote saying, hey, in America, it would be like United States v. so-and-so or state v. so-and-so or Commonwealth v. so-and-so.
Yeah, or people v. so-and-so.
Right. When it's the Queen or Rex or Regina, it means
the king or the queen.
Yeah, I mean, basically the state, right?
Yeah.
Of England. So,
well, it is a monarchy. I actually think that's important here too.
Yeah.
I think that contributes to the, because it's true that it's a constitutional monarchy. So it's true that since the successful conclusion of the civil strife in England in the 1600s with the arrival of William and Mary in 1688, I think I got that right, it's a constitutional monarchy where the constitution really constrains the monarch.
Right.
We're no longer talking about Charles I's claim to absolute power.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a monarchy, and therefore the people whose behavior is being adjudicated are not citizens. They're subjects. They are Her Majesty's subjects.
Right.
And therefore, that could inform the court's sense of what duties they have and how those duties arise and how they're explained.
Right. They're subjects with rights.
Of course.
Which is a key difference between...
But they're not citizens.
...living under a despot, which, again, you would see a totally different... further to your point, right? If the system were otherwise, there were no rights. If they were pure subjects.
Yes.
Right? Then you might see a different opinion yet.
True.
Right?
It's possible.
In the limit, there would be no obligation to give them reasons for their punishment at all, right? That's pure despotism.
Yeah, it'd simply be either punished or not punished
right.
At the sovereign's discretion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that discretion does enter here after judgment is passed when the sentence is commuted. But
so let's talk about, like, I just kind of want to go through the opinion in pieces.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially with older opinions, there often aren't as many nice road signs in
yes.
terms of headings and paragraphs. And
yep.
sometimes you'll run into huge, long paragraphs. And so sometimes you got to put in a little bit of work as
yeah.
as a modern reader to kind of pull out the outline.
To make your own roadmap.
You make your own roadmap, yeah. And so sometimes when I excerpt cases for students in law school, I will actually insert paragraphs where they should go.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like... I don't like looking at walls of text, and I'm sure the students don't either. This one, you know, I excerpted quite a bit from, and be interested to hear if you think I did an okay job in terms of what I took out. We start with the facts here, and there's the court kind of has a long block quote from the court below, the trial court, which decided what to do with this jury's special verdict in this case. And so there's the facts as that court, as the jury found them and as that court processed them, are relayed in some detail.
Yeah.
probably, you know, certainly much more detailed than is strictly logically necessary to compute an outcome if you think that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not what we're doing.
It's quite atypical. I think the word special is an indication that it's a quite atypical way to ask for and get a verdict from a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Conventionally, I think then and now, you are simply asking for a thumbs up, thumbs down. Yes or no, right? Is there liability or is there not liability?
Right.
Is there guilt or is there not guilt?
There may be multiple counts, so they'll have to say guilty on this, not guilty on that.
Right.
But usually you don't ask them specific questions, but you can, even in American law these days.
You can, but as a default, we don't. To get them to agree to a statement of facts that, as you said, is kind of lengthy. I mean, it goes on for many lines describing the jury's agreed sense. So these, we know they deliberated apparently and agreed that these are the facts as they understood and found them to be.
They came to a story that they agreed was the story, and there doesn't seem to be much dispute about the facts. Maybe there's no dispute about the facts in this case.
Yeah.
One other thing that this opinion pointed out that I think is worth emphasizing is the difference between a jury's verdict, even in a case where it's answering questions, guilty, not guilty, liable, not liable, and a judgment in the case, like the role of the judge and the jury. There was recently a case that was in the news where it was like an intense interest and the jury returned a verdict. And immediately there were news stories, jury orders so-and-so to pay X million dollars. And of course, that's not what happened at all, right? A jury doesn't order anything. A jury's verdict is nothing until it's converted into a judgment, until a judge enters a judgment on the basis of the verdict. And of course, there are rules and laws about how a judge should handle a verdict. And there's
Indeed.
Some discretion about that too. But there is a judge does not have to enter judgment consistent with a verdict. The judge can set the verdict aside as inconsistent with the evidence under certain rules. And of course, either side may, depending on whether it's a criminal case and some particularities, may appeal that and say, hey, the judge should not have set aside the verdict. The judge should have entered judgment on the basis of the verdict. And so, but the point is that it's judgment that ends a case, right? It's judgment that actually orders someone to pay money or to go to prison or the like. It is not a jury verdict. And so the fact that a jury was asked to say something here that would then cause the judge to do another thing is not unusual. That's what always happens. What is unusual here is the nature of the jury's fact finding,
and that it is a detailed factual recitation.
Right.
The typical practice of simply asking for a verdict, guilty, guilt, not guilty, or liable, not liable. One thing that can do is actually fail to surface the fact that the jurors don't all agree with each other about every one of the facts.
Right.
Because we don't ask them to write out a piece of paper that they're all willing to sign. I agree with every word of what's on this page.
Right.
We don't ask them to do that. Now maybe we should, but we don't usually.
Right.
Here's a narrative about what occurred.
Yeah.
And it was disputed, and here's what we think happened. That's interesting.
Yeah, in America, it's totally possible that half the jury could think that the criminal defendant robbed the store in a certain way at 8 o'clock, and another thought they robbed it at 9 o'clock. And the question is, did they rob the store? And the answer is yes, guilty. Even though they totally disagree about the story of how that happened.
Yeah.
So there's some logical, there's interesting logical things about what guilt means and beyond a reasonable doubt means that one might ask about this. But in this case, it does look like maybe nobody really disagrees about the facts. At least that's how it comes to us, that this recitation is what, at least for purposes of this appeal,
right,
we are taking this as what happened.
Yes.
And
we're just wondering what the legal upshot of that is.
Right. And that's almost always the case on appeal. Occasionally, people will appeal factual findings. Appellate courts are loath to overturn factual findings. There's a very high bar for saying that the evidence was insufficient to support the verdict or that the facts were found wrong. It can happen. But ordinarily, appellate courts are going to be reviewing the application of the law to some set of facts that we're going to assume for purposes of this appeal are the actual facts, either because there was a judgment entered below or we're on summary judgment or on a motion to dismiss or something like that, where we're just going to assume certain facts are the real facts because the dispute here is one of law. And in this case, that kind of seems right. But I think as we think about, you know, what is the purpose of reciting these facts in this way? I don't know how you felt about it, but as I was reading the story, my intuitions about, I had intuitions about like whether they were guilty or not. Like, was this murder? And it kind of kept changing, right? As I was reading, you know, you could read this fact they were, you know, many days without food, and mm-hmm. water was hard to come by. But then there was this boy who seemed to have nothing to do with it, and he wasn't asked to participate in this. And there was someone else who dissented, and you know, they could have survived a little bit longer, and they tried to on this turtle, and then other things happened, and then they conclude that they wouldn't have survived had they not killed this boy. When they did, they wouldn't have survived the 4 days before the rescue ship. So the way the story is laid out, A, B, C, D, E, as a narrative, as some kind of like, almost like you're reading a work of fiction. Just like when you're experiencing a work of fiction, your sympathies for the characters, your understanding of the characters' motivations may change as these facts are relayed.
Yeah, because you're learning new things about the situation that they were in.
Right. And you're learning new things about like what they're deciding, but also what you learn later, like when you read a novel, kind of may change your opinion. Oh, I had the wrong idea about this person when I started reading it.
Right. Could.
And so I don't know if the students had different intuitions as they were reading the facts. If when they started, you know, if I just told you, hey, there were a bunch of people in a boat, they were starving to death, they were in danger of dehydration, would have died in that way, and they couldn't have all survived, and so they killed one person. If you stated at that level of abstraction, you might have one intuition about how, I don't know what that would be. People argue and differ about that. If you relay very specific facts about how the killing unfolded in this particular case, you might have another intuition about it. That's all a way of saying that the facts matter in our intuitions about the justice of a case. And we'll come back to the idea of justice a little bit later in the course. I don't know. Does this make sense to you, Joe? I mean, as you read the facts, I mean, how they kind of prime you. It's not just that we're getting a set of facts on the table that we're going to then apply the law to in a very direct way. It's we're kind of priming the pump in a little way, in a way for the argument that's about to happen.
I think that's true. I think I'm more attuned to that fact in conventional legal materials where I know that, if we're talking about an appellate court opinion,
right?
I know that the appellate court wrote the fact section too.
Yeah.
And here it's presented to us a bit differently, right? Which is a jury agreed on these words, right? So it's not the court of appeals writing these words. It's the jury writing these words.
And the court below, which added.
And the court below is sort of is like packaging that up and sending it along.
And saying, hey, here's, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the reason why that I'm sort of more sensitive to a way that reading the facts can shape how you think about it as you're reading is because the appellate judges who write these opinions are very well aware of that.
Right.
And write opinions accordingly.
Yes.
Okay. So now it's also true in this instance, reading these facts, like I do recall thinking to myself as I was reading about it that I thought, oh, you know, if they had, because there's this discussion about maybe they'll do lots and they decide not to. Do I have that? I think I'm remembering that correctly. Yes.
You're thinking of the subterranean. Yes. I think in this case too, but also in the.
So they think of doing that.
Yeah.
And then they decide not to do it. And that made me think, you know, if these people.
I should say, there's a very famous article.
Inspired by this,
with slightly different facts, which makes it even trickier.
Yes, because small differences in it will make a huge small differences in the facts could make a huge difference in your reasoning.
Yeah.
But here, when I saw that, I did have the thought, you know, if they actually just do this by some kind of lottery, right? And they actually all did that, in a way, it seems more like suicide than murder.
Right.
And that. Because there would be this voluntariness of the person who died.
Even if once they're chosen, they say, no, I don't want this
to
happen.
Well, I mean, that's a further complication, right? So, I guess I was envisioning, like, they do a lottery and the person who is chosen agrees. This is, because I would have wanted to go ahead if you had been the one chosen. I'm the one chosen, we'll go ahead, right?
Right.
So in that instance, again, if you're asking about kind of the legal feel, the legal vibe there seems more like suicide than murder.
You see, and the point for right now, at least, is just that just in talking about the facts, your mind is already leaning into what the law is going to say about those facts.
Yeah, because it's not our my first time at the rodeo, so yeah, it's like, right. I have a sense for where these things sort of roughly land once you start making certain distinctions.
Right. And so I say this partly because, especially for beginning students, I think the most important thing to do when you first read a case is at least to establish what the court thinks it's doing. And it may be, you know, this case is well-reasoned in some ways. We'll talk about it. But there are cases which are, I think of personally, as kind of batty. It's kind of, and even those, like, it's important if you're appealing those, if you're understanding them. First, on the court's own terms, what does it think it's doing? And the very first thing to figure out usually is, like, how does it relate the facts? Like, what does it understand to be the factual scenario underlying the dispute that it is making some judgment about?
Yeah.
And as you look at those facts, like, notice what your own intuitions are.
Sure.
And after we relate these facts, then we need to identify, okay, well, there's some fight here, obviously. Here it's between the state, you know, the crown in this case, and some criminal defendants. In a tort case, it would be between a plaintiff and a defendant. And so there's some fight that comes out of these facts. Like, the facts tell the story of, like, where does the dispute arise? And then we have to identify, okay, well, what law applies to decide this dispute, right? So the crown says, I think that you're a criminal and we're gonna punish you, and they're defending. And so what law governs whether the crown can punish in this way? Because as you said at the very beginning, this is a monarchy, but it is a monarchy where it's a constitutional monarchy where citizens have rights, and also beyond, there's a basic rule of law. And so in order for them to punish, there needs to be some law explaining, saying, justifying what that punishment is. So that's, and here I think it's obvious, right? I give this case because that's not really a difficult thing to identify what the law is here. It's murder, right? The claim is that this is murder.
Yes.
And one thing to note here is, unlike in the United States today, and unlike in the United States has been for quite a long time, although not forever, this is murder in common law. So it is. There's no statute here that forms the basis for the prosecution. We can't just look at a statute to see what is murder, what is necessity, what is self-defense. We can't, like, look at all of the exceptions and just say, oh, well, this is murder because these facts occurred, so there was a killing here, it was purposeful. And when I look at the necessity defense or a defense of self and others defense, it says these things have to happen, those didn't happen here, and so blah, 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 right? Which is why you might go down a statutory pathway, but even there, I think you and I would have something to talk about with, like, well, what do those words mean? And
of course,
do they include this, right? So,
and we would likely be talking about not this case, perhaps, but a case that was tougher to figure out given the words of the statute,
right?
Which is an important sense in which what the law is shapes what people decide to fight about in front of an adjudicator. Like, the fact that they're in front of the adjudicator is a suggestion, is an indication that there may be things to articulate that favor each side, such that they might each think they've got a fair shot at winning.
Mm-hmm.
And that the cases that are reflected in judicial decisions are sort of that set of cases. The easy ones probably aren't going to lead to as many disputes in front of judges.
Right.
Because the parties will just figure out what to do. I suppose in a criminal matter, a defendant could ultimately conclude, I need to plead guilty because there aren't any defenses and they can really show that I did that thing. And, maybe they'll be more merciful if I just admit that I did it, for example. Right.
Yeah. Well, these days in America, you would, plea bargaining is most of the criminal justice system.
Indeed. No, I think it's harder when, perhaps it's harder in this English context. These, all the punishment for a huge number of felonies is death.
Right.
At this point in time.
Right.
So it's kind of hard to take that step and plead guilty to something where the next stop is the noose.
So
perhaps
we're going to apply some common law here to figure this out, which means judge-made law. And so we're going to look at a bunch of old cases. The judges will consult these older cases, determine some principles, think about the connection between those principles and the facts in front of it, and do a lot of the kind of legal argument stuff that we've talked about in class and in prior conversations. Although for us sitting here today, Joe, much prior, but for the students just a few days ago.
Right.
So what everyone agrees about here in this case, right? The general outline of what murder is, everyone agrees on, and everyone agrees there was a purposeful killing here.
Right? Sure.
So this is not a difficult case in terms of like, what was the intention of the actor?
Right.
You know, and everyone also agrees that there are some kinds of, and I'll just say here, necessity defenses, but put quotes around that, right? Because maybe that's a term of art and maybe that's something to be decided, but there is at least some defense to murder for situations in which your life is at stake. So self-defense, for example, someone is coming at, an aggressor is coming at you with a weapon, and it was reasonable to think that they were going to kill you,
right.
And how reasonable, whatever.
And you're cornered.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like you can make an escape. It really is you or that person.
Right.
It seems to you in that moment, reasonably, you could believe.
Yeah.
It's that person or me.
Yeah. And now I've not read a bunch of old English cases about this, so I can't speak, you know, but let's stipulate that was a defense to murder. Defense of self and others is a long-standing defense. It's certainly in our law in the United States, across jurisdictions, and I imagine is a very old principle at common law. Its precise ambits, I'm not as sure about, and I think this court is not as sure about, right? So,
sure.
So we've got this hole here. Like, what do we do? This is not exactly like that situation where there is a clear defense, right? But it does bear some similarities to it, right? It's necessary to preserve my life that I kill you. That's the essence of this defense.
And that is stated in that general way, that may be the only similarity.
but of course,
that's what creates the issue.
Exactly.
Because there is a way to state a thing that was true of that prior case and the rule that it generated.
Right.
And this situation, right, it is necessary that I kill you to save myself. I want to preserve myself. That entails killing you. Like, that's a true statement in the mouth of the defendant. It's true here and is true in that prior case, not just in the defendant's mouth, but in the court's mouth. To preserve yourself, you needed to kill the other person.
But so when we create these targets that I've associated with legal duties, you know, the thing that I have to prove is met. You know, I've got to prove that the elements of this statute are met. You know, I have to prove that this, you know, if it's a no vehicles in the park rule, I have to, you know, and I'm the government, I have to prove that you were on a vehicle and that you were in the park. And, you know, so these things that I have to prove, law is all about determining what is similar and what is different.
Yes.
That's the essence of creating these targets, right? Is you create categories and you figure out, okay, well, what's in this category, what's not in this category. In fact, like, all killings are different. Like, this was a killing on a boat.
Yeah.
There could have been a killing in a store or a killing in the courtroom. There could have been a killing in a house, right?
Right. There's
no law of the universe that says that all of those killings need different rules of law to process.
True. Right? And it may be that in the very we would have had to be there and someone would need to write it down or something. But like, I mean, there was a first time that a court was confronted with a killing in a boat.
Right.
And the person who was accused of the killing in the boat and was about to be punished for it might have said, but wait a minute. All those other times it was a killing on land,
right,
not in a boat. And this was a killing in a boat. And you should think differently about that.
Yeah.
And the court would have to decide, like, does it matter that it was in a boat or does it not matter that it was in a boat? I mean, that happened at some point, presumably.
I'm the defendant. I'm saying I'm a student of our law and this is a boat killing.
Yeah, and
you
can
talk about our land killings.
Yeah, and you can look
at
all
those terrible boat killings aren't as bad.
Yeah, they're not as bad, and you can look in those books all day.
Right,
and you can search high and low, and
right,
you're not going to find any cases in there.
No,
any judges who talked previously about killings on boats. So it's like, it's a whole new ball game according to the person who killed on the boat. Like, and we have to decide what we make of that.
And that's a matter of, like, you know, if the target is land killing and I made a boat killing, my facts are I killed on a boat. It's not going to hit that target, right? My case is not going to be one which is encompassed by a land killing only category or land only killing rule or
right,
target. And so,
right, so if you're the prosecutor, you want to build a target that is killing the other person intentionally, not killing the other person on land intentionally.
Right. And if you're a judge, and lawyers are kind of participants in this process, right? The process is figuring out, well, what, how big is that category? How small is it? What's in it? What's not in it? And what are the, more importantly, like, what are the kinds of reasons that we give to say how big that category is? And like, the problem with the land boat distinction is there's, at least as I think of it, I can't think of a good reason to treat boat killings differently from land killings. However, if these are boats which are going far over the ocean in circumstances which are very different from what happens on land, maybe we do want an area of law that applies to boat killings and has different defenses. And
right.
But, you know, if it's on our local lake, probably it seems like every other killing, right?
And also, it could be that the rules that we might like to have for boats on long voyages, maybe the intentional killings we would want to treat largely the same, but maybe the deaths that are the consequence of accidents, right? Different sorts of accidents happen out at sea, I would imagine, than happen at land. And the precautions you can take might be different at sea than the ones you could take on land. So there could be accidental deaths. And the criminal law cares about those too, under certain circumstances. So you start slicing this in various ways, and you maybe sometimes it's the same and sometimes it's different.
And so this is a case where, as I started explaining the defense here, I had to kill you in order to save my life.
And I intentionally did that for that reason.
I intentionally did that thing. But the reason for the killing was to save my own life.
And that doesn't seem to be in serious dispute.
Exactly.
Their lives were in peril, that the killers followed through and used the corpse in just the way that their claim about needing it to live would right. suggest, right? Which is that they ate it.
And so I want to jam that reason into the set of reasons that we loosely associate with defense and necessity or so. In other words, Your Honors, there are all kinds of reasons that that people who kill other people are not prosecuted even, but certainly are not convicted and not executed, relating to defending themselves. And here are all these cases. The case of Old Man Johnson, who, you know, took a hatchet to a burglar who was in his house with a dagger or something like that.
And was charging at him, and he defended himself. Yeah.
And my case is just like that, because had he not killed, he would have been killed. And had I not killed, I would have been killed. These are right. exactly the same. And what the court is taking notice of here is that these are not the same from the perspective of the court, right?
Right.
You know, other courts could disagree. Say, yeah, those are the same. Anytime your life is threatened, you know, on a philosophical theory that like the preservation of the self is the paramount like duty and right that we have. And therefore, this is just a preservation of self case. Those are all the same, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. Right. This court says no. This case is different in a way that should matter. And it does it by talking about morality. So it kind of gets into moral and cultural expectations about how one should conduct themselves. There are situations where protecting the self is not enough to take you out of the murder statute, where, as they say in here in several places, the state expects you to die, right?
Right.
You're expected to voluntarily to die.
Now, putting that backward into the self-defense story of that you were just riffing on about, you know, you're in your home and it's getting burgled and there's a confrontation and the burglar charges at the resident of the home and the resident defends himself with the axe he fortunately was holding at the time. I think if you ask yourself, oh yeah, we should prosecute that homeowner for killing that burglar because they intentionally killed the burglar. That's a murder. And a person could hear that and say, wait a minute, do you just expect the homeowner to stand there and be killed? Right. I mean, that's sort of what you're saying, right? That it's, you know, you should just let the person kill you because to preserve your own life by killing them, which seems to be what you need to do, right, in that scenario, preserving your own life, that's the wrong choice. We're going to prosecute. That's a crime. That sounds weird to say of somebody, you should just stand there and let the person kill you.
Right.
Like that's your duty, right? In the scenario we've been talking about. Now we're taking that and we're asking about this new scenario where Parker, sick, laying in the bottom of the boat, isn't charging at anybody with anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in the same situation. They're all hungry, thirsty, and know that they're not too far from dying if they don't do something different than they're in the, that they're doing at that time.
Well, let me outline. So I think the first thing, if you kind of try to break up, you kind of look at the text of the court's opinion, you try to break up, okay, what are its reasons? It's visiting different areas of reason as it kind of moves along in the case. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that it does is this like pulling apart categories thing that we just talked about, right? It says that, no, this is a different, this is all defenses of self are not the same. And here are some examples where society, either as a moral matter, a cultural expectation matter, or a religious matter, and it gives examples of all three of those,
right,
expects you to die voluntarily rather than to kill. And so it is not the case that that defense of self is always a justification that the law should accept, and the law shouldn't accept it because it's not morally, culturally, or religiously acceptable in some melange of those things. So that kind of says there might be a different category here, right? In fact, we think there should be. So is this the kind of, is this decision to kill, to preserve your own life when the person you're killing is not threatening your life? Is that a situation
that's not threatening it in the way that we had encountered already? Because you can imagine Dudley saying, wait a minute, he was threatening my life. He was not cutting off body parts and stuffing them into my mouth. Right. And in that way, he was threatening my life.
Well, yeah. Right.
So this is all about choices and talk and how people talk and rhetoric, what makes sense.
That's super important.
Right.
And all of that rhetoric goes into how we feel about these categories that we're creating. And I just want to note that the first thing the court does by going through all these examples is to suggest that there is another category. Now, should we treat it the same? Okay, so those are different, right? And there are cases where we morally expect maybe people to sacrifice. That doesn't necessarily mean that the law should expect that. The law might recognize that that indeed, when you kill someone else to preserve your own life in this way, the way that happened in this case, that also is an excuse from the, or a justification, we won't get into the difference, in criminal law.
Right.
But maybe for a different reason. Like, it's not the same as the aggressor case, but also one where, so maybe. But the court kind of keeps going. So not only do we see these as morally different, and not only is this a different category, but there are a lot of problems with recognizing a defense in this case.
Right.
And midway through the main paragraph, the court says, suppose we did adopt this defense. I just want to, let me read a couple sentences here.
Sure.
Almost to the end, right? So, suppose they did adopt this thing. To preserve your own life, it's a defense to killing somebody who has basically nothing to do other than in the rhetorical way that you mentioned, but you know what I mean, as in this case. They say, who is to be the judge of this sort of necessity? By what measure is the comparative value of lives to be measured? Is it to be strength or intellect or what? Well, again, that seems hard, right, to make those kinds of judgments, doesn't it, Joe? I mean, they chose this kid because he was a kid. He didn't have a family. He seemed like he was weak. There are all kinds of considerations that went into whose life is more important to preserve here.
Right.
And the court is like, that is a really tricky moral question. Compare that to the self-defense case, where the answer is the person who's not trying to kill someone else, right? The person who, and there's this complicated theory of double effect and everything, like, I'm only killing you to stop the killing of me. I wish I didn't have to kill you to do that.
Right.
Right? But it's the only way to stop you from killing me. And so... So it may be morally justifiable to use self-defense in that circumstance when there's no other way to stop the aggression. So the criteria for who dies in that situation is really easy. It's the person who was the initial aggressor who has to be repelled, and it's the only way to stop. Here, not so much. Like, you began by asking, like, if they had cast lots, you would have felt differently about it. Well, that's another way of deciding who dies. These are all quite complicated, and if they set up this defense, it's like, well, who gets to decide? You know, what if the cabin, was he a cabin boy? I forget. Now I'm doubting myself because I don't have the case in front of me.
Yeah, he seems like he was just there as a worker supporting the trip they were taking in the boat that sank.
Yeah.
Right? Because they were sailing on a larger boat. This is the smaller boat that they get in because of the storm or something like that. And so, he was like you just think of crew. Like, boats have crew. And he was like a crewman. Basically. Unlike them, he doesn't have family at home, right? And of course, you could imagine...
He's in league with one of the others. I have more years to live.
Right, exactly. You could make those... If he were conscious, of course, he was unconscious, basically, we're told, in the bottom of the boat. But had he been awake and alert, he might have said, it makes way more sense for the oldest of of us to die because you have the most life to enjoy. I've had the least life to enjoy. Right. What are you talking about? Right. I'm the one who should die, right? And what would you do in the face of that? Because that sounds plausible, right? So,
so there's kind of a one point here is that that you would set up a situation where people are making these policy-based judgments about life and death, and you've kind of licensed them to do it through the law,
right?
And then you have to make a decision about whether would we make a decision about was that a reasonable choice or not? Are they guilty because they didn't cast lots or because they chose the older rather than the younger? It gets to be all quite difficult. And that may point you towards saying this is not a thing they should be deciding at all. This doesn't seem like a kind of decision they should be making. Compare that to the case of self-defense, where, in fact, it doesn't, like as you say, it doesn't really matter what the law says. People are going to defend themselves from someone who's coming at them in the main. I mean, there are some exceptional cases, but in the main, if someone's coming at you with a knife, you will do everything you can to repel them, including, you know, doing something lethal.
And expecting them not to, again, in the sort of the run of cases,
right,
is, you know, well, okay, you can expect it all you like. It's not a good understanding of what it's like to be a person.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good understanding of what it's like to be Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original Star Wars as Vader comes at him. It's like, you strike me down, you'll make me stronger than ever, right? So there's a guy who's willing to get killed. But that's not, like, that's the exception that proves the rule.
Well, it's also fictional. So there's it's very
that.
Exceptional.
There's that. But it's like that's a totally weird scene. For this very reason, right? This is how people act.
I'm just trying to suggest that, yes, so you point out that there's an obvious moral difference, right? The law is asking of someone what it should not be asking for kind of moral reasons. There's also an efficacy thing. And so I'm kind of previewing the different kinds. We'll talk about this more in class, like utilitarian versus moral.
Asking for the impossibles is maybe like, not a great thing
to do.
The
law is totally useless because it doesn't matter. Even if law says that you have to lay down your life, people will not because of just the nature of human beings. And so, whereas if the law says clearly, if you're in the shipwreck situation, don't do this.
Right.
You will be executed when you come back or you will be prosecuted. That is a situation where you might stop to think about whether you will try to preserve your life long enough to be rescued by eating someone else. Right. And this sounds like, well, how often is this going to happen? This sounds crazy. But as we were discussing before we started recording, back in the 1800s, there were a lot of ships and a lot of shipwrecks.
Right.
Right.
And you start to worry about, like, if you really wanted to think about the consequences of allowing this defense, and like, okay, would the defense work if they had been drifting for one day fewer than the number of days they actually were drifting? How about 2 days? How about, it seems like the boat is going to get back to dock late and I'm feeling a little peckish. Right? Do I just get to start cutting pieces off people's bodies? I'm hungry.
I really do want to hear your answer to that question.
Like, I'm hungry, and you know we're not in dock yet. I mean, but why wouldn't that argument be just as good there as the defendant's argument is here? Of course, and you say, well, but that's very different. Indeed, there will always be differences.
Right.
The question is to treat them the same or not.
Right. And that's
for reasons.
That's kind of the core mechanic here. Right. Is that we're giving reasons why law should take account of this difference and not that difference.
Yeah.
And so as you know, this is for the students, as you read through this, like ask yourself, is this a difference I would take account of or not? Like, how would I define this category? How would I define self-defense? Would it just be the aggressor situation? What if they had cast lots? Would you have a rule which would excuse people from murder in that case? Why not? Think to yourself, this is often a good exercise. Like, however, you're going to read a case, you're going to read facts, and you're going to feel strongly often about a case, sometimes not so strong, but you usually have an opinion. And then ask yourself, okay, if I had to argue against this, what would I say? If I had to write a dissent to my own opinion, what would it look like? And another way at that is whatever opinion you're asked to read, ask yourself, how would I write a dissent to this opinion?
And it helps in trying to think through how you might explain reaching the contrary outcome. It might help as you're thinking about these things to ask yourself the question, like, why was this hard in a way that stopped the parties themselves from figuring out the answer without needing the court's help?
Mm-hmm.
There won't always be a good answer to that, but sometimes there will be a good answer to that. I think Popov against Hayashi, that's an especially good question to ask to understand what's happening in the case. But that's a way to ask something along the same lines. You know, what would I say if I had to write the opinion coming out the other way?
Mm-hmm.
Is like, okay, you're not thinking of yourself as a judge. You're thinking of yourself as an advocate, right? And acknowledging, yeah, you know, my opponent has some good arguments. Like, what is it about this case that's hard? Because they have some things to say that sound right, and so do I.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that? What is the space created by the conflict between what sounds right about what they're saying and what sounds right about what I'm saying? Because we're not both going to be right. One of us is going to turn out to be wrong.
Last thing I'll say on this is that I excerpted a bunch of like case discussion and other things, which made the opinion a little bit more complicated, unnecessarily complicated to read for our purposes in this class. But you read this and you might get a sense that like, it all seems kind of loosey-goosey. Can I make any argument? And it seems like there's just kind of some critical thinking here going on and some like moral reasoning. And there was some additional case discussion that I left out. I'm not sure that it actually made a difference in terms of giving you more of a solid kind of corpus of law to hang on to here. The basic question is kind of what you see here, right? Like, what are we going to do legally about these kinds of moral and practical reactions we have to this? We will see that, you know, in typical cases that we'll be talking about in this class and that you encounter in American law, there is more of a body of existing law and kind of statements of rules, statements of standards, statements in statutes and constitutions that you will have to work with. There are fixed points that you kind of have to work around.
Yep.
We will see there is often, if not always, maybe always, some play in the joints. Like there's almost always an argument you can make. This is an example. This case gives us an example that looks like there's a lot of play in the joints, right? You can make any kind of moral utilitarian argument you want to, and that's fine at this point. All I want you guys to do with this case is to think critically about what arguments do you find compelling? Mm. If you were to draw other categories here, what would they be? Like, if this isn't self-defense and not the kind of necessity which should excuse murder, like, well, what other categories are there? And do you agree with what the executive did in this case, which was to grant clemency? You know, they got was it 6 months?
6 months in prison being executed. Right.
Instead of being executed. And like, is that the right result? And if so, doesn't that suggest there's some kind of exception to murder that this case actually falls into?
And it's even more interesting than that in the sense that I think the court itself makes a comment that suggests that the executive ought to think about clemency.
Right.
And it is interesting for a judge to say that at the very same time the judge is handing down the decision that they should be executed.
Yeah. Which suggests that there's something about that. There's some category that the judge has in their head.
Right.
That suggests this case is not like the normal murder case.
And they even say, the Lord Chief Justice Coleridge even says toward the end of the opinion, you know, don't think I'm saying that they were in an easy situation. Judges have to lay down rules sometimes that they would not themselves be able to follow.
Right.
That's quite a resting thing to hear a judge acknowledge that we're trying to provide norms of conduct. And we know of ourselves that we would not always be able to uphold those norms of conduct. Nevertheless, we need norms of conduct, and we need to be prepared to insist on them of each other in order to be able to live together effectively.
There's kind of an interesting, maybe more advanced question here about, like, is what the judge is really saying, is it to harken back to its discussion of the complicated, like, drawing of lots versus this, who's to say whether they did the right thing, that those situations are so diverse that maybe the executive is in a better position to determine whether they did the right thing under the very particular circumstance. In other words, it's hard to draw a general rule like we like to apply in courts, and maybe this is better set up for some kind of administrative or executive decision. You can put that aside if you want to, students, but there is a tradition in American law that suggests some things courts are better suited to decide by rules and standards, and some things maybe better left to administrative agencies, as we will see a little bit later in the course, or to executive, maybe a little bit. This essentially is that, isn't it? This is a legal process decision. But I think we've gone on way long enough.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's way long. I think I just coined a new phrase.
Way there. Long enough.
Way long enough.
Not merely long enough. Way long.
Which
enough.
Which is to say, just right. But boy, is it way.
It's like saying in New England, it's not just cool; it's wicked cool.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, Joe. Thanks.